Hey, Bill and Gunn, welcome to Black Hawk Tribal Edition. It's all happening here at SYG HQ. Black Hawk Tribal Edition is the name of the show. And, you know, we talk about sovereignty and a few other things to do with that and Indigenous rights, etc. And joining me for this part, first part of the show, is Yirilam, Ganyara and Bumi. So we've got a big, the heavy hitters in today. And it's all about the election, I guess, for now, and all the promises or gammon promises and this, that and the other and pointing the finger at each other. Ganyara, welcome to the show. And, yeah, it's all happening, and a few promises already have been shot down.
Look, yeah, you know, the election's on again every 4 years, of course, for the federal election. I see that Peter Dutton has come out and said there won't be a Voice 2.0. There's no more referendum on that from his side if the Liberals get voted in. So that rules out that idea. But look, even that, we even said back in the time that the Voice was doomed to fail because that was for Indigenous, you know, the Voice for Indigenous Australians. Aren't all Australians created equal? And that's the important part. But, you know, so, okay, let's rule out the Voice. What are they going to really do for the Australians? We don't know. It's probably got nothing to do with us because we aren't Australians. Yidinji were never part of Australia. They were always excluded. And it's only when you take up citizenship inside their world that you, the human, through that person, that legal identity, that political identity, that you have to go and vote. And it's your person that votes and not you. You know, just a curious side note here. They say they're going to take it to the polls. Look up the legal definition of the word poll. It means a photograph of the head and shoulders. Okay, they're going to take their election to the photograph of the head and shoulders. That looks like an identity to me. So, you know, that's where it's at with that. And Anthony Albanese has made a few gaffes as well. So who do you really believe? That's the question.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it's going to be interesting, Kalnar, to see what's going on there. But at the end of the day, your identity just keeps moving forward.
Yeah, well. Oh, yeah, we're going to keep going, and there's something should have come for us, the tribal people of Australia, that seeing all the mad people going on and, you know, about, like, food for the land and all this, and we got flood, that's good, you know. We need rain, and but how the way they're going, they're just like two big kids, you know, growling over this, over that, and they never satisfied. And I've got a shield on my granddad, and, you know, of this land, and that satisfied me. But I need more than that. Yeah, it's a sovereignty dingy man, and yeah,
that's beautiful. And Yirilam, I guess you've seen it all before. I mean, once you've seen it all, there's a formula, I guess, to it all. The only thing is that it just keeps changing majority. Sometimes the Greens have a bit of influence or some independence, but ultimately it's always a two-horse race.
Yeah, you're right. It has gone around in circles, and, you know, it, as you said, it's, you know, it's outside of Yidinji, so it doesn't have a great deal of impact on us. But in saying that too, from an Australian, any First Nations person who holds an Australian identity has, as you said, have seen this before, and it goes round and round, and there's promises and broken promises, and it doesn't take too long to become monotonous. And, you know, hey, what's a possible solution is get outside the race, you know, create your own nation. Sovereignty is definitely a pathway forward.
Yeah, Ganyara, I think once again the importance of it there is it's the same game, and you look at the history, Howard and versus Keating or Hawke and Fraser or Whitlam and whoever else it was at the time, you know, all these things are, it's really not satisfactory.
Well, let's have a look at the figures for a start, because you mentioned Keating, which is another rather interesting point. Let's have a look at the percentages inside Australia. Let's have a look at 97% white fellas, 3% Aboriginal fellas. So what's going to happen? Is the Aboriginal people going to have their say when you're only 3% of the population? I don't think so, because in a democratic nation, the majority have their say. So Aboriginal people don't hope to get much out of it. You know, like Dutton said, there's going to be no more Voice referendum. Okay, we don't need recognising inside the Australian Constitution other than for the legal treaty negotiation between like someone like the Yidinji Nation, whose sovereignty coexists with Australia, by the way. So we're going to have some sort of formal agreement there, and that's what maybe the recognition is all about. But let's have a... You mentioned Keating, which brings us up on another rather interesting point. Just recently, the international ICC had Duterte arrested. Duterte was the head Sherang over there of an Asian nation. And he said that he had killed people. And the ICC said he had murdered a lot of people over the drug wars. You know, that they were the government had declared war on drugs in the Philippines. So they arrested him over that. But let's go back to what Keating said, 1992 in Redfern. We done the murdering. Hang on a sec. Why isn't Keating got his sorry hide arrested by the ICC? Why? Because Australia is a member of the ICC, the International Criminal Court. He should be arrested because I'd say Australia has done more killing and more murdering than what Duterte even thought he could do. You know, they're talking, you know, thousands of people for Duterte, but let's have a look at what happened to the Aboriginal people. They say there was over a million people here at the time of settlement. What are we down to now? What was it really down to at the low point? 100,000 Aboriginal people? That's 90% wiped out. So wouldn't you think that would be a crime against humanity? Not just murdering, but then they said that we also took the land. We stole their country. We stole their children. Hang on, that's genocide. Let's have a look at what happened. So maybe Australia needs to have a good hard look at itself, and the international world needs to look at Australia as well for what has happened. They stole children, they murdered people, they stole land, they done everything they could do wrong, and yet they want to escape the International Criminal Court. What's the good of the International Criminal Court if it can't sort out this mess?
Yeah, very interesting. Bumi, there's been a lot of crimes here when you look at like Bones Knob and, Gandaja, Bunna Gandaja, Blackfella Creek, all those things there. And that needs to be, like, put in a good way, really.
Yeah. Well, a long time ago, like, they took my great-great-granddad over to Germany, Munich, and there was passing him around like football. You know, he went to that big place like Canada, Canberra, and they waxed him from here, and we had to go and bring him back. They couldn't work because he was making a lot of noise, tending to labor, he's dead, and then we had to bring him. He's in Brisbane now. Now, they took all our shields away and all our stuff, you know, a bunch of them old people, you know, and not only us, all Australian, and that's a really, really hurting thing for Aboriginal people. I mean, say, we don't want their bone, you know, we put it down. But that's why our things, they really putting it on display, you know, making a big joke out of it to me, and that's not right for the tribe. The family, you know. And, that's a hurting thing, and we're going to bring it back to this in Brisbane, but there's a lot of other stuff there too, shields and boomerangs and vibra. Cook or stick, you know, we want them thing back. I mean, and that's a thing that, you know, like stolen generation or it's really genocide, all those sort of things, you know? Yeah.
Yerlam, thank you, Connor. The matter of genocide is not only here. Recently you went to the United States and, you know, the Europeans have been there for an extra couple of hundred years, but... you know, did you come across any of that type of evidence or meet people that tell that story as well?
Not in that particular trip and other journeys over there, absolutely. And, you know, it's so similar in its story to here. And you've got both a combination of, the colonisation where the dispossession of lands happened with the original people there. And then you've got the next story of, you know, bringing slaves into the country from outside of it, which was experienced here. It seems to be 200 years further down the track. That's probably the difference, and that just means it's more hidden and more covered up. And, you know, one of the expressions that I've heard in the past from a very respected First Nations woman of this continent described her culture as being, you know, masters of emotional intelligence. And for me, that means a level of maturity that involves morality. And, you know, you talk about truth-telling or, you know, confronting what's in front of you. Well, the level of emotional challenges that seems to be happening on this continent seems to be more like the head-in-the-sand approach, where if you ignore it, it might go away. And yet it can't unless these sort of things are addressed. And that's the only way that will enable to move forward. And, of course, the Yidinji way is about settling the past and securing the future, and that's how it's going to happen.
Yeah, Colin, those things that you talked about, the shields and all the Yidinji material in Adelaide, Brisbane, London, who knows where they are, all these things, they're going to have to come back sometime, but there needs to be a place here, and you want something to bring them back and put it into a building that, you know, is for that. So future generations can have a look at it, eh?
Yeah. A few meetings that I've been with some people here that, you know, we tell them about this land and they said, oh, we're going to tell us a story now. I say, it's not a story, it's true. What happened here a long time and where things gone and we need them back, you know. Like the museum, I've thanked them for them, look after it, but I need them to say, here, Uncle, you can take it all back now. And give us a place in Gimore here. We need a place here to show our lot, our family, our tribe. You know, it's too much money going down to Adelaide or Melbourne or Canberra or anything. Some of our lot don't like flying. They're used to driving, but it's a long way. We haven't got the money. We need them thing to come back, and we need the council up here who's in charge now to give us a place where we can put it in a lock-up. Yeah.
Yeah, that's, you know, the other thing too is like, you know, Albanese or them prime ministers, they never come talk to you about those things. It's something that would be good. But Ganyara, at the end of the day, it's all about Yidinji moving forward now and building its world.
Well, it's not only Yidinji, by the way. It's all of us together here on this part of the world, you know, this continent here. It's about, like Yiralim just said, we've got to settle the past first and then secure the future for everyone. And this is the most dangerous part for Australia. It's up for grabs at present. And unless Australia gets its act together, you never can tell which other UN member state may want to do a deal with the Aboriginal nations. But we're working it very sensibly. We're very controlled in what we're doing. And there is a method to what we are actually doing. I can't speak... I can't speak Afghani for a start or Spanish. So, you know, that rules out a lot of countries for me. I can speak English. You know, I can't speak Chinese or Japanese or Korean. So that's ruling out quite a number of countries. However, we just got to be very careful as we move forward. You know, not us, more so it's the other Aboriginal nations. And I really say this with all sincerity. We're trying to protect Australia from itself. But Australia must do something for Yidinji, like Uncle was saying there. Give an area for the museum. We don't want to take all our country back. We don't want to take it off the white fellas, that the mums and dads that have bought a house through their hard work. We want them to have their house. We want them to have a root title married to their title. So, you know, they got security. So what we're looking for is for the Commonwealth to show a little bit of initiative for the Australians, be it Dutton, be it Albanese, or Pauline Hanson, or anyone else, the Greens, it doesn't really matter. They're all running forward, but they're going in the wrong direction. They're all talking about Aboriginal Australians when they should be really talking about the gap which really exists is between the coexisting sovereignty. So the only one who can fix this problem are the two coexisting sovereignties that can't be fixed within Australia.
Yeah, that's right. And we've been saying that for many years now, and unfortunately, I just think it's falling on deaf ears. There might be people with goodwill inside the Australian government, let's say, but ultimately they're not the ones making the choices and the decisions. So you might get academics, sporting heroes, whatever it may, you know, the average mum and dad that support Yidinji, for example. There's a lot of them here. And because we're not out to hit them up with big money and just whack them with a stick type of approach, that's a very good thing. And that's the plan that the elders put out from the very beginning, because, you know, there's some places around the world where it got messy. You just have to look at some of these nations you mentioned already, even France and Europe now. They're very, very... you wouldn't want to be there. with all due respect to our European friends. But ultimately, it's not too bad here. And Kalner, it's quite peaceful here, but it's peaceful because Yidinji was here and is here still. It's not peaceful because of anyone else.
Well, you know, hey, I was born on this land, and even though my culture isn't necessarily traceable back through this continent, I've only got, you know, maybe a half a dozen generations compared to my close friends who, you know, can just go back tens of thousands of years. And yet that's the message that I've received and been fortunate enough to have lived through my life is the cultural approach, which is embracing. It's unconditional love. It's something which is very special. And as you said, that's what guides our approach. And, you know, I feel this from Bumi, and I feel this from so many of my close friends. And it's so important. That how else can the world move forward unless it's united? So that's the way that Yidinji moves.
Yeah, and that's what I was alluding to, that peace and quiet and tranquility that everyone's after has to be done through the tribes, Gunyara, because ultimately Australia has got everything from the tribes, including the Australian accent, for example. It's why it's very unique, because it's different. It's all the languages that have been here, the pre-colonial languages that have added to the Australian English, for example, that makes it very ochre or, you know, gives it the accent that it enjoys today. But everything, the beaches, the lifestyle, the whole lot.
All on the back of the Aboriginal people, by the way, not on the back of the sheep. Australia was founded on the back of the Aboriginal people, and that's actually written in case law in Mabo, in the Mabo case itself, you know, that the Aboriginals underwrote Australia. Now, what a position to be. Now, why would Australia want to bash the Aboriginal people? Why do they want to? You know why? Because they want to be the 3% Australians. If they went back to their true and correct capacity and standing inside their sovereign nation, their tribal nation, the one, by the way, not us saying this, the one that the academics of Australia, the best that Australia could muster in 2015, the best constitutional lawyers, all come out in 2015, 16 and 17 and produced the Uluru Statement from the Heart. Go and have a look at who produced that statement. You know, there's some really very highly educated, qualified lawyers and academics that know the Constitution inside and out, and they said, not us, they said the sovereignty of the Aboriginal people coexists with the sovereignty of the Crown, of the Australian Crown. Welcome to Australia. You know, if you want to be Australians and vote in the next election through your legal identity, which you most definitely can if you hold an Australian identity, you have to go and vote through there, and you vote for those who support and do the right thing for the Aboriginal people that can secure the future of Australia. Not just leave it hanging on a thread, because, like I said earlier, if they leave it hanging on a thread, someone may break that thread and grab what you want to call is the territory of an Aboriginal nation and occupy it and colonise it properly, and do it through treaty. Now, what would happen, say, if the British come back and did a treaty here to resettle this place properly, do a proper treaty with Yidinji? So we'd have to tear this piece of the map out of Australia, wouldn't we? Because Australia won't have the territory that we have, because it's all of a sudden signed over, in part or in whole, to the British. Now, what would happen? Think of the consequences, because the British were here. They left, they decolonised, but they left the manifestation of colonialism, which is the Commonwealth of Australia, by the way. They left it sitting here, which is against international law, the international conventions, that any form or manifestation of colonialism must leave in a hurry. And that was in 1960, by the way. And, you know, that's a few years back. That's 65 years ago. They should have left, but they didn't. And so they've been hoping that we don't learn this stuff so that they can stay here. But we have.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few of us that don't hold Australian identities very clearly. At some point in the dream time, but those things were given back, just like you can give back your membership to a football club, or let's say an RSL, or because you're moving town or another jurisdiction, for example. The Australian citizenship or nationality, let's say, is only conferred to Aboriginal people. It's just an offer, but they still haven't secured it correctly in accord with the international law realm.
Well, look, it's all contract. It's all contract law, contractualism. The whole lot of citizenship is all about that. If you go and read the preamble of Citizenship Act 2007, it makes it very clear. You get full membership inside Australia if you abide by these conditions, obey the law, all that sort of jazz, defend Australia. Really nice stuff. But it's a contract nonetheless. And remember, you, the people that are listening to this, are not the person. You're a human being that is seen legally and politically through the person. And the only way you can participate in the Commonwealth of Australia, for example, is through the Australian identity. Now, you can participate in the Aboriginal nation through the identity, the legal and political identity of that Aboriginal nation. So you've got two worlds to participate in. The sad part is most people on this country, 97%, only have here one identity that's available to them. So the 97% are actually at a disadvantage because they're seen through the Australian identity. Look at Pauline Hanson, for example. I'll agree 100%. She's an Indigenous Australian. Most definitely is. That doesn't mean she's of Aboriginal descent. Now, all Australians are Indigenous to the Commonwealth of Australia. However, when I look in the room here now, I see Bumi. He's Indigenous to Yidinji. He's not Indigenous to Australia. He's not an Indigenous Australian. He's Indigenous to here, as I see Bumi. And that's the very difference you are seeing legally and politically through an identity.
Yeah, you know, you got these football teams like, I won't say the Eels because they're gammon, but might be something like the Titans, for example. The Titans not even from here as a like an Indigenous thing. But Bumi and other things are from here. This is the land it's from. You got sea eagles and all that kind of stuff too, which is fair enough. But I'm just trying to use it as an example there. To really, when you look at some of those older places now, their names have changed because of that decolonisation process. In India, for example, the English used to call it Bombay, and now it's called Mumbai, and I think Madras was Chennai, or it's now Chennai or something like that. Anyway, correct me if I'm wrong, but all those names have reverted back to what you would say is the original title. The same here. There is an original title, Gimoibara, Gurawindai, and other places around the traps here on the Gimoi Wallaburra Yidinji territory. But when you're looking down south a little bit, there's another name place there, and you know, at Dheeral and other places, there's stories to do with that. That's why it's called Dheeral, you know. But what I'm saying is that the Yidinji history is alive, the sovereignty is alive, the people are alive, the culture is alive. What isn't happening at the moment is Australia's recognition and full acknowledgement of that and the respect that it deserves.
Simply because the Indigenous Australians, which is what they want to class the Aboriginal people as, that there is a legal piece of paper, like I said earlier, the poll, the picture, the head, the picture of the head and shoulders, that's all that's going to the election, that's all that participate in the society, the human. Through that poll, through the head and pictures, you know, the picture, you participate in Australia. You show me where is the Commonwealth of Australia. I defy anyone to go outside their door and point to the Commonwealth of Australia. Where is it? It's a map, and the Commonwealth of Australia hangs on the wall. It's the Constitution. It is all paper. The world is paper. But us as humans have been convinced that we are the paper. No more. We're not the paper. We are seen legally and politically through the paper. We can participate in Australia or we can participate in our world, in our Yidinji world. And this is the important part. We are humans. And that's what human rights are all about. But it's given to the legal identity of Australia, for example, of our legal identity. It's got human rights as well. This is the important part. Humans and persons are totally different things. Humans and citizens are totally different things. They're pieces of paper, the citizen, the human, whatever. But when we go and look at our real country, that's our country. That's our world. That's Bumi's world. That's down here. When I'm down here with him, this is his world.
Exactly. And that's the most important thing is that, you know, I couldn't do this, what I'm doing now, if I was using a Japanese name. It had to be a Yidinji name to activate and build this office because that's what the tribes, you know, you have to do it that way. Once you accept the name, you accept that that's the law. The same way you accept the Australian piece of paper and the Australian name, you've got to accept the law of that part. Like, let's pretend it's a tribe. But if you got a Kukuyalanji name or a Yidinji name, for example, you've got to say, well, I'm going to use that name, but I'm under this law here. You can't say that you're not. But ultimately, like you're saying, Ganyara, to help with that, because it can get a bit tricky, because some people are changing their names inside of Australia to tribal names, but their identity is still Australia, and they keep themselves on that side, which is why we're saying no. Murrumu is on this side, and John and Mary and whoever else is on the other side. You can't mix it. You know what I mean?
Well, yep. Uncle, you go.
So like when Gribble came to Yoruba, they asked him at risk, who's in charge? They say, you got to see Bo or there. Well, they gave him in Charlie. So he had to go see Dad there. But Dad seen him coming towards him. So Dad was ready for him, you know, to tell him, we don't need you, you're trouble. You know, you can see it, you know, that you don't want people coming to you in a way like that. You know, we've got that senses, feel, touch, taste and all this. And he told him to leave, you know. And then that's when the Gribble started to come up and threaten Dad, you know. Because Yerlamina and Kanjala and Murrumu, it's a really hating thing, you know. I've got to stay with them, not run away or anything. I took them around, and that's where all this walking and camping, you know, and all these places around here, and they're real, real stuff. And when I got into Gimoy there with a big fig tree there, oh, jolly knocks me there. And now I got a photo of Dad, you know, and it's a big thing that track and all this and that. And you know, there were no McDonald's along that road or anything like that. It's, you know, this car or taxi. Like Mum walked from up there, Georgetown, and his brother, and a few others. And today that you and I got it easy, but these three fellas here are jolly little lighting me up here. And something I've got to pass over, you know. It's just like when I read it, if it's a hard bit, I'll jump it, you know, jump it. So getting a bit shaked up here. So, no, that's good, and that we're going to keep it up. One fella said to me, Uncle, the train left the station. I said, no, you can't talk like that, you know. I said, we're heading for the right stuff here, and we need to talk, you know, and let it out. So the other lot in Australia can hear us, you know, that come with us, you know.
Yes, and, you know, one of the stories I like is, and I used it a few times on the show, is the story of Joseph, who was a, you know, he used to interpret dreams and he had a rainbow-coloured coat, multicoloured coat. Anyway, he was sold into slavery by his own brothers, and when he was sold into Egypt, the Egyptians gave him an Egyptian name because they said, no, you're one of our subjects now, so we're going to give you this name. And Joseph became Zaphpath-Paneah. Zaphpath-Paneah, with that name, he went all the way up to the top, number two in Egypt. He couldn't go number one because that king had to be Egyptian, as he's a pharaoh. He was the boss. But Zaphpath-Paneah, he even used that identity to go all the way up to the top. But he still was from the tribe of his father, which was a Jewish tribe. So when he died, he made them promise to take my bones back to my country because that was the custom of the day. So these are things that have already been around for a while, and the same way that Koiki was using Mr. Edward Mabo. We're going to go to a break now. You're listening to Black Law Tribal Edition right across the country. We'll be back after the break with some very, very quick comments.
Hey, Yan Yamok, my name is Aaron Peterson, actor, Arunda, Arabana Nations. I just want to let you know that you're listening to 98.7 FM BBM.
And welcome back. We're going to a two-part series now about UNDRIP, the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And this perspective is from Canada. It's a two-part series, so we'll have the second one next week. But it's a video, audio from a video about UNDRIP and its implementation into Canadian law.
Hi and hello. You're about to watch a presentation about the Declaration, or UNDRIP. But before you begin, I just wanted to make a few introductory remarks. You'll learn in this video about how, despite the progress on UNDRIP today, we're really just starting the first few chapters in a much larger process. However, despite how much work ahead remains, the importance of UNDRIP in the path that it's leading us on can't be overstated. If properly implemented, UNDRIP could finally lead to the fulfillment or renewal of historic treaty relationships. I'll explain what I mean by that in more detail in the following presentation, but this journey involves many steps. That means that the UNDRIP story is only beginning. Unleashing UNDRIP's power for advancing Indigenous rights will be a long process, not a singular event. And yet, as far as laws go, there aren't many more exciting or with greater potential for advancing the rights of Indigenous peoples. This great promise and the potential, of course, carries with it the burden or risk that UNDRIP fails to live up to its potential for progressing Indigenous rights. That's a risk that I'll speak to as well in this recording. But the key way of avoiding that is by doing what you're doing right now. Learning about UNDRIP, getting it, knowing it, understanding it, and sharing it with others. That learning process about UNDRIP starts with knowing about the work that was undertaken by Indigenous peoples at the international level, getting international recognition of Indigenous rights, and the setting of global, universal standards. That work was, of course, followed by the domestic laws that seek to braid those universal rights into Canadian laws. But as we'll discuss together in this presentation, saying that international standards apply here at home is only a beginning, not the end, because there's a larger process of putting those standards into practice. And implementing the universal rights under UNDRIP that apply to all Indigenous peoples of the world, or making those rights a reality here at home, is the task that confronts us today. So let's begin. Thank you for joining me on this talk about UNDRIP, which is short for the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. It's also called UNDRIP, or even simply the Declaration. And whatever you call it, by any name, it marks a monumental opportunity for advancing the rights of Indigenous peoples. But before I tell you more about the Declaration, let's start with some powerful facts. Did you know there are nearly 400 million Indigenous peoples around the world? To give you an idea of how big that number is, if all the Indigenous peoples in the world lived together as a single nation, that country would be bigger than all but two other countries in the world today. I point that out to start us off because the work and accomplishment of the Declaration involved Indigenous peoples from all over the world, including those from Aotearoa, New Zealand, Australia, Latin America, Africa, and yes, especially Canada. And this joint effort helps to show how strong Indigenous peoples are, especially when they work together. Because make no mistake, the Declaration would not exist if not for the work of Indigenous peoples. Indigenous peoples hold a shared recent memory in terms of the wrongs that they've been inflicted by the history of colonialism. And the Declaration was created at least in part because Indigenous peoples wanted to improve on that aspect of our shared history. So let's talk about your rights. I'm Nick. I'm a lawyer. And I only represent and fight on behalf of Indigenous peoples. I've been working all across Canada to advance Indigenous rights for a while. Until recently, I lived and worked in the Northwest Territories or Denendeh. Before that, I lived in the K'tikmeat region of Nunavut, working primarily with the Inuit of the Western Arctic. And today, I live in Vancouver on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. And putting the Declaration and the rights that it provides into action is a big part of what I do. I've been working on putting it into effect at federal, provincial, territorial, and Indigenous levels. I point that last one out because I don't want to make the international instrument sound as though it's just part of federal, provincial, and territorial laws. I also help my clients make it part of their Indigenous laws. I eat, sleep, and dream about the Declaration because I know the promise that it holds and its limits. No matter how much you know or don't about the Declaration right now, I'm about to tell you everything that's going on with it in Canada over the next half hour together, including why it's important and what you can do to get involved in terms of making the rights it provides to Indigenous peoples a reality. And I want that to be the biggest takeaway from this video, the things that we can do, all of us, you, me, and your communities in leadership, to propel the Declaration forward, because we don't have to wait for Canada to show us how to implement the Declaration. Remember, Indigenous peoples were the ones that put the Declaration together, and they'll be the ones that put it into action. So here's a snapshot of what I'll talk to you about. It involves a discussion of past, present, and future. First, let's talk about the work that's already been done on the international aspects of the Declaration. Then I'll talk about where we are now with the new law that the Canadian government created to make the Declaration binding and enforceable in Canada.
Last, we'll discuss where this work is going, what's likely to happen next, including the development of Canada's action plan, how that'll be done in partnership with Indigenous peoples to ensure that Canada's laws finally meet the standards in the declaration. So, UNDRIP, what is it? The declaration is a short document laying out best practices that countries should use to protect and advance the rights of Indigenous peoples. It also sets up a framework of minimum rights that Indigenous peoples worldwide need to survive, live with dignity, and be healthy and happy. By legal standards, it does all this very efficiently, as it's a relatively short document containing just 46 articles or sections, and then 24 preambular or introductory statements. The preamble is just a simple introduction providing background to the declaration, including its purpose and its guiding principles, and how to interpret the rights that are inside it. But the individual articles, the nearly 50 of them, they're the actual beating heart of the declaration, each setting out the specific rights that it identifies. In total, it's not long, maybe 20 pages or less. And if I held it up as a book, it wouldn't look like something that would take you much longer than a short morning to read. But as we'll discuss, its scope and its possible effects are huge, massive, and if implemented fully, they could be potentially transformative. And this is mainly because the rights it recognizes for Indigenous peoples go beyond those currently recognized in Canadian law. They have the potential to raise the standards of Canadian law. So we just discussed a bit about what the declaration is and why Indigenous peoples created it and fought for its recognition. Now let's talk about when it started and how it evolved at the international level. As mentioned, it was Indigenous peoples that went to the United Nations and asked for an instrument recognizing their rights, not Canada or any other country. The declaration is not a Canadian idea. It's an Indigenous one. Equally, its start was at the international or global level, not the domestic. And Indigenous peoples began the work of achieving global consensus on their rights in the 1970s, starting at the highest of levels, going directly to the United Nations Assembly, which is like the world's parliament. And even though the United Nations is made up of about 200 countries and only countries have a vote in its parliament, Indigenous peoples were directly involved in every step of making the declaration. They were the ones in the back room drafting, and they were in the assembly watching the votes for member states. And it's because of this tireless work by Indigenous peoples that the declaration was finally approved by the United Nations General Assembly in 2007. But this background about the declaration always leads to two big questions. One, why did Indigenous peoples start at the international level, not the domestic? And two, what happened over those 30 years? The approach of starting at the international level made a lot of sense to Indigenous peoples because of the long history of colonial governments around the world dispossessing Indigenous peoples of their lands and their resources under phony doctrines such as terra nullius or doctrine of discovery. Fighting this together at the international level benefited all Indigenous peoples wherever in the world they were because it acknowledged that there exists a shared history from colonization and its related impacts. And the Declaration expressly condemns all forms of discrimination against Indigenous peoples. Settler societies around the world were founded on white supremacy, colonial oppression, and the erasure of Indigenous peoples. The Declaration recognizes that ending this is vital to reconciliation or the beginning of a new relationship. But it took a lot of hard work and compromise to get to that point. Over 30 years, starting in the 1970s and 80s, the Declaration began and a draft was mostly finished by Indigenous peoples as early as 1995. Yet it wasn't officially approved internationally until 2007 or 12 years later. And this was after a significant period of conflict in 2006 and 7, where concessions and compromises were made. More, even then, there were some notable countries who refused to adopt it, namely the four amigos, New Zealand, Australia, the United States, and yes, Canada. All, of course, share in common their status as colonizer states that are 100% situated on Indigenous lands, and none of which wanted to recognize Indigenous rights in the Declaration because of their status as colonizer states, but Indigenous peoples prevailed. So this leads us to the next part of our discussion on what's in the declaration and how can that help to explain all the foot dragging and lengthy delays by colonizer states in affirming it, even at the international level. In moving to an analysis of the articles of the Declaration themselves, it's difficult to cherry pick just a few articles to discuss, but I've sought to do it anyway on this slide. And I didn't happen to choose those at the front end because I got lazy. Instead, it just is a coincidence that these articles at the front of the Declaration all deal with the same aspect of rights, and that is self-determination, or what I call the umbrella right. And I'll speak to why I call it that in a moment, but while self-determination can mean a lot of things, at its core, it's actually pretty simple. It means the sovereignty to govern oneself. Essentially, that means the right to make one's own choices. And in the context of a collective right or a community right, that means the right to develop one's own programs, services, rules, and laws to fit with the unique needs and circumstances and culture of the community. And that's why I call it the umbrella right, because the right to self-determination or to choose for oneself or one's own community provides a big tent for informing and giving life to all the other specific rights within the Declaration. And Indigenous peoples knew this too, which is why they fought so hard to ensure that these three provisions on your screen didn't get weakened or watered down as the United Nations member states worked on the Declaration. For example, world governments did try to do exactly that. They tried to change self-determination to self-management, which would have meant significantly less at a legal level and could have been interpreted as meaning merely the right to administer or be delegated the powers and laws of others. But Indigenous peoples stood firm. And it's important that they did, because interpreting the Declaration is just like any other law. And to show you what I mean by that, I'm going to turn you all into lawyers for just a brief moment. See, one of the key rules of statutory interpretation for reading a law or any rights-bearing document is that you need to read and think about each article, provision, or clause along with the rest of the document to fully understand how it should be interpreted. This means that the power of the self-determination provisions can serve to affect or strengthen all the others. So if these self-determination provisions mean that Indigenous peoples have the right to choose for themselves and that their communities have the right to govern themselves, we're then moving toward a situation where Indigenous peoples' permission or agreement must be sought before any action that affects that ability, or any of the other rights listed in the Declaration in such a way that could stop or prevent self-determination from occurring. And this is even more powerful when you think about how many different things are in the Declaration. And while I'm not going to go through all of the articles of the Declaration, the nearly 50 articles can generally be sorted into four general themes, namely 1, territory or land rights, 2, justice and the right to be free from all forms of discrimination, 3, freedoms and the right to cultural identity, and 4, self-governance. And you can quickly see from such broad themes that the Declaration and its rights are as broad as it gets, covering the full spectrum of rights that Indigenous peoples have. And by doing so, each of these thematic sections works together to reinforce and support the others, as you again don't read and interpret the individual articles in isolation, but together as a whole package or bundle of rights. And again, that includes the consent-seeking process that meaningful self-determination necessarily requires. And this is a huge change from how Canada does things now, which is just under a consult or engagement model before affecting Indigenous rights. And that's really the ugly gorilla or elephant in the room. The whole consent-oriented or negotiation-focused standards that exist under UNDRIP and how they are such a game-changer for potentially breathing new life into Canada's current duty to consult and accommodate model that exists under Section 35. But before we go into that, because it's a big part of FPIC, you've probably heard before or many times, free, prior, and informed consent, is what FPIC stands for. Before we get into that, I want to talk a bit about Canada's evolving positions on UNDRIP and how we got to where we are today. And I'll start before doing that by just stating what the Declaration doesn't do, because I think it's important that we all are on the same page about this aspect. The rights that it protects are not made or given by the Declaration. We need to remember that the rights in the Declaration do not come from settler states or any other nation state, or even the Declaration itself. Instead, the rights in the Declaration are inherent and universal rights that are held by all Indigenous peoples. That means that they are natural rights. Indigenous peoples themselves are the source of those rights. The source is not any external government. What the Declaration does is merely provide formal recognition of those rights to help advance their revitalization and protection. Further, the UNDRIP equation is additive only. And what I mean by this is that UNDRIP only supplements and complements existing Indigenous peoples' rights. It can't diminish, supplant, or replace any Indigenous rights. So UNDRIP doesn't take away or subtract from any recognized Indigenous right or any existing agreement or treaty. In terms of UNDRIP's 46 articles, one of them, Article 37, states this, exactly this, very clearly. In fact, since the Declaration very clearly states that Indigenous peoples have a right to the recognition, observance, and honorable fulfillment of their treaty rights and other obligations that states have agreed to in any agreement or treaty, you could go further and say that UNDRIP supports such treaties or agreements. The other way that UNDRIP supports existing treaties and agreements is that UNDRIP serves to raise the floor of agreements. This means that UNDRIP is not a distraction or taking away from any modern treaty holders and their ability to continue to implement their treaties. Instead, what UNDRIP does is it raises the minimum rights. So it creates a foundational floor that needs to be recognized by the parties, not just when they are implementing or interpreting treaties or agreements that they've made with one another, but also in the negotiation of agreements that are to come in the future. So in that way, UNDRIP provides a foundation for the minimum standards and interpretation that is to be given to treaties and other agreements between Indigenous peoples and nation states. So UNDRIP is a foundation and floor to ensure how states and Indigenous peoples implement their relationship with one another to ensure that it's based on upholding rights in a way that braids the coexistence of Indigenous laws with nation state rights, doesn't replace Indigenous laws or seek to extinguish Indigenous authorities. And this is important to point out because Canada has a very different history than this. We have a long and ongoing history in Canada of seeking to use treaties to extinguish Aboriginal rights at the same time that Canadian treaties recognize rights. So this language of cede, release, and surrender that exists not just in the peace and friendship historic treaties, but also modified versions of the same extinguishment language is found in all modern treaties in Canada as well. And it's important to note that, you know, these types of clauses do not adhere to the minimum standards for Indigenous rights protection that's found in UNDRIP. Because ultimately, the minimum rights found in the Declaration go above and beyond those that are found in existing Canadian law. To be clear, Canada's current constitutional law, including court decisions and even treaties, don't meet the minimum standards of the Declaration, at least not in all respects. So as shown in the previous slide, treaties, whether modern or old, which Canada traditionally treats as their gold standard for honoring and respecting Indigenous rights, they all contain ugly clauses like cede, release, and surrender, or other certainty or modification provisions that Indigenous people had forced upon them in order to get Canada to agree to recognize the rights that are in those agreements. And those clauses violate the Declaration. And fully implementing the Declaration would mean requiring amending those agreements and voiding those clauses. Because as the Declaration rightfully says, forcing Indigenous peoples to give up their rights so that other rights can be recognized is neither fair nor honorable, nor is it in line with basic minimum rights. So along these lines, we see how UNDRIP offers the promise and opportunity to improve upon the way Canadian law recognizes and advances Indigenous rights. But we also see how it starts to explain why Canada took such a long time to agree to support UNDRIP at the international level. And then, as we're about to discuss, even once it did, Canada stopped short of taking any action to carry that commitment forward into Canadian laws for quite some time. This marks the end of part one of this two-part video on UNDRIP and its implementation. In this video, you learned about the international creation and progress of UNDRIP. In part two, we'll move forward from that history to the current process of bringing UNDRIP into domestic laws. That is, taking it from New York and the halls of the United Nations to Ottawa and the nation's capital and into Canadian law.
And that was the first part, calling Bringing UNDRIP Home, the United Nations Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples implementation into Canadian law. We'll have part two next week. We'll be back after the break with some final comments.
Hey, all, this is Bake the Boy, and you're listening to Radio BBM 98.7 FM.
Yeah, welcome back to the show. That went pretty quickly. Ginyara, just some final words from you today.
Look, don't get too wrapped up in the election. If you're of an Indigenous nature or of an Aboriginal nature, don't get too wrapped in the election. You vote for those who are going to do the best for the Aboriginal people and who may push for a proper treaty between all the coexisting sovereignties. So that's who I'd be voting for as a group. But don't think your real power lies there when you're 3% out of the 100%, because that leaves 97% saying, no, we don't really want to give much to the Aboriginal people, because the last referendum absolutely showed that 60% of Australians didn't want to give anything to the Aboriginal people. So that's within Australia, but not outside of Australia. When we're outside Australia, where we are, then we've got to be the ones who lead the way for the Australians and show them what a real Aboriginal nation can do, and that is to secure the future for Australia.
Yerriman.
Just absolutely. It's that choice of enforcing and creating the paperwork around what has always been for so long belonging to the different nations of this country, their sovereignty. And it hasn't gone away. It's still here now and will continue to be.
And Bumi, some final words from you today?
Yeah, well, hope you're listening to the wireless when we come on. It's very, very good, you know, that. Take care and keep looking up, you know. Yeah, you have a good day now, Colin.
And that brings an end to the show today. Gai Baragalanunda, may God's peace be upon you in the almighty name of Yeshua HaMashiach, Jesus Christ our Lord. And in the good book, it says in the book of Romans, don't pay back evil with evil. Be careful to do what everyone thinks is right. And that's what Yidinji's doing. We're not going out there pointing finger and this, that, and the other and saying you go back to England or Japan or wherever, you know, your mob's from. This is about doing the good thing.